Well, good morning, everybody. Great to be back together again. I always enjoy day two of these meetings. Everybody's very upbeat and enthusiastic after an exciting first day. Lots of positive discussions. Everybody had an early evening, good night's rest. The sun is shining. So we're all looking forward to lively discussions today. I think we have continue to have a very good agenda and look forward to everybody's active involvement, just as we had yesterday. Our first topic we're going to discuss deals with accounting changes and the impacts of those accounting changes on auditing. As you recall, and I mentioned yesterday, we discussed, and we had Larry Smith here last time discussing the pace and volume of change in front of us. Today we're going to move a little bit went into this in more detail with a greater focus on the nature of change that's taking place and looking at the nature of that change and the impact or potential impact on auditing. So first I'm going to ask Charlie Niemeyer to lead us off on this discussion. Charlie, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, Marty. Certainly we did have a discussion at the last SAG meeting and I think fairly focused on the speed and volume of the proposals. It's rather unprecedented in those regards. Today, we would like to focus more on the substance of the proposed standards, and in particular, auditability. For our financial reporting system to be effective, it's no doubt it must be reliable, and auditability is closely related to reliability. Certainly, through our inspections, PCAOB has a great deal of information. Yesterday, you had some insight into that in our discussion of the 4010 report related to the economic crisis. I think Denny Beresford was right in his insight that we our findings related to the economic crisis are probably not unique to the economic crisis. Certainly we continue to find our findings related to fair value auditing. Auditing of goodwill of estimates are a consistent theme in our inspection reports. And I sincerely hope that the PCAOB will publicly share these insights and continue to do so as we, as I believe information such as this could be beneficial not just to the to FASB but to the public at large and setting the accounting standards. So with that, I'll turn it over to Tony Lopez, and Deputy Chief Auditor.
Thanks, Charlie. This morning what we wanted to do is review some of the key changes to the standards, and our objective is to focus on key changes so that will serve as a basis for determining which of those changes present auditability issues. And after that, we're going to then have a discussion of the topics in the briefing paper that was sent. The first standard in the deck is the revenue recognition standard. As many of you know, the FASB is moving away from the traditional longstanding earned and realized approach to recognizing revenue and has adopted a contract asset and liability approach where you record contract assets and liabilities and recognize the changes in those as revenue, a balance sheet approach, if you will. The revenue ASU is applicable to most contracts involving the delivery of goods and services with some exceptions, for example, leases and insurance. And in the briefing paper, we outlined the model for revenue recognition, which is you identify the existence of a contract, identify performance obligations, determine the transaction price, and then allocate that to the performance obligations. The under the proposed standard, recognition of revenue occurs only from the transfer of goods or services. So if you have contracts for the construction of assets, for example, the degree to which you recognize revenue will be based upon whether control is transferred. If it's transferred continuously during the contract, you'd recognize revenue. If it's transferred toward the end, you would recognize when control transfers to the buyer, generally speaking. In terms of the identification of separate performance obligations, that's similar to what is done today in practice with multiple element arrangements where you basically look at the deliverables and unbundled deliverables.
What's a little different about performance obligations is that the performance obligations have to be distinct, and that's defined as either they're sold separately or they have a distinct function and profit margin. But so you'll have some similarity there, but the unit of accounts may be the same. In terms of licensing and right to use, one of the things that the new proposed standard calls for is you would look at the exclusivity of the license and the term of the license. Licenses that were exclusive licenses for the economic life of that license, you would get a sale model with revenue recognition up front, generally speaking. If the life was less than the, if the term of the license was less than the economic life, you would have revenue recognized continuously during the term of the license. And if it was non-exclusive, you'd recognize revenue no earlier than the inception of the agreement. In terms of effective credit risk, collectability, as we pointed out in the briefing paper, is no longer a recognition threshold issue. It's something that the proposed model would include in measurement. And the FASB has taken many troublesome, what have traditionally been troublesome revenue recognition issues like rebates, concessions, price protection, and they factored those into measurement rather than being recognition thresholds. As it relates to the use of estimates, the FASB in its own document says this standard will require significantly more estimates than are used today. And for example, in the transaction price, you would use the relative standalone selling prices to allocate the transaction price to different performance obligations. I think practice currently is having some getting up on the learning curve in using estimates because of the two EITF issues 081 and 093. So that would be similar to the evolving model today. In terms of accounting for costs, cost would be expensed unless there is a particular gap that allows deferral of costs, or if the costs relate to the fulfillment of the contract, they're direct cost, and they will be contractually recovered through the revenue contract. One point I'll note about the revenue standard is, as of yesterday, there have not been significant comment letters issued because the deadline is October 22nd. Moving on to the financial instruments exposure draft, this represents also a significant change in the model. As of yesterday, there were over 2,000 comment letters, and I think yesterday many people noted about in the 4010 report there are significant issues that audit firms sometimes have in dealing with fair values, and in this standard, one of the changes, the first change we have up there, is that most financial assets and liabilities would be measured at fair value. Some of the comment letters that the staff looked at in terms of audit issues raised, some said that loans and non-marketable equity securities, for example, may not have a readily discernible market, and therefore that's going to require the use of more level three fair values, and some have suggested that would reduce comparability. Other commenters on the requirement to fair value have said the requirement to fair value certain equity instruments may be difficult to operationalize because of the lag in getting the underlying information that investors, that issuers typically have in doing their normal equity pickup. Now that they have to fair value that, some have said that would be perhaps more difficult to operationalize. In terms of classification based upon intent for held to maturity securities today, it's an intent basis, whereas in the new proposed standard, it will be based on business strategy, that is the strategy of someone holding the instrument to recover or pay the contractual cash flows at the end of the term. Comment letters on that particular, some comment letters have raised issues about it's the business strategy being unclear. For example, can you have a deviation in a business strategy? Does it matter if the strategy is a long-term strategy versus a short-term strategy? And some of those commenters have requested more application guidance to address those issues. Core deposit liabilities would be measured at current value, and they would be remeasured. And demand deposits that are not core liabilities would be subject to fair value. A number of the comment letters on that particular aspect indicated that remeasurement that would be required for core deposit liabilities is subject to significant judgment. It may result in the creation of a new measurement attribute that may be confusing to auditors. In terms of the impairment model changes, there will no longer be a probable threshold for recognizing impairment. Rather, an issuer would look to current and past events and would not be allowed to look to future events. And some of the comment letters have also expressed the need for more guidance there because some have said certain indicators that are used in determining impairment may embed forward-looking sub-indicators, and therefore, practically, it may be difficult to separate future from current events when considering impairment. And then finally, up there, hedge relationships. We included that in the briefing paper. The focus is a move to more qualitative assessment at using a reasonably effective threshold. Now, many were supportive of the reasonably effective threshold. Some of the questions that issuers raised was that they were concerned that auditors and or regulators would come along and impose what I'll call a belts and suspenders approach, where they come in and maybe informally mandate a quantitative approach in addition to the qualitative approach. There was one large audit firm who applauded the board for including a reasonably effective threshold, but they were concerned about regulators coming in and applying a similar belts and suspenders approach. In terms of the fair value ASU, now the FASB in the exposure draft indicated that they didn't believe that this was going to result in significant changes in practice, and many of the changes were done for convergence purposes. One of the changes we highlighted in the briefing paper is the requirement for a level three uncertainty, measurement uncertainty analysis, and the document essentially says that if changing one unobservable input to a different input could have reasonably resulted in a significantly higher or lower fair value, that you would need to disclose that. Comments, some comment letters on that in terms of auditability were along the lines of requiring an entity to disclose a second estimate that it did not come up with may be misleading. Others indicated that the phrase could have reasonably been used and the term significantly are not defined, and that may lead to diversity. And there were some large financial service issuers who commented on third-party pricing services relative to this requirement. They said the availability of the information to do this disclosure may be difficult to get from pricing services, and some pricing services treat that information as proprietary. And even if you can get it, there is a lag in terms of getting that information timely for quarter and year-end reporting. And others said even if you overcome those issues of availability and the lag issue, that different pricing services use different methodologies. So one issuer may have a disclosure that itself is not comparable because it's based upon two different pricing services with different methodologies. Skipping down to the third bullet there, the current valuation premise under FASB guidance for highest and best use includes two approaches, in use and in exchange. And in this proposal, the FASB is eliminating those, and they've said that the concept of highest and best use will apply to only non-financial assets and liabilities. So for financial assets and liabilities, you can no longer, you can't measure them based upon grouping. You have to look at the unit of account. The FASB included one exception, which says if you're managing market and counterparty credit risk, offsetting risk, on the basis of a net exposure, that you can measure the fair value at that unit of account of the portfolio. And as we say in the slide, you can do that if the risks being offset are substantially the same. Some have commented that substantially the same isn't defined, although there weren't as many calls for application guidance in this instance as in some of the other instances. The final bullet up there is simply that 157 was focused on establishing valuation premise for assets and liabilities, and the FASB made an amendment to say that if in terms of valuing an entity's own equity that's included in shareholders' equity that's required to be measured at fair value, you should take the same market participant approach. And the example was, for example, in a business combination where you're issuing securities to affect the combination. The last standard that I want to cover is the contingencies disclosure proposal. There were over 300 comment letters that the FASB received, and the comment letter deadline was extended. We focused in the briefing paper on the requirement to disclose remote contingencies, asserted remote contingencies that may have a severe impact. And the requirements for disclosure are publicly available quantitative information, other relevant non-privileged information, and information about insurance and other recoveries if they're discoverable. Now, two themes that we saw in the letters that we looked at were that what is publicly available, what is non-privileged, and what is discoverable are items that require legal expertise that auditors may not be in the best position to make a judgment on. The other comment, and I would say at least of the letters we looked at, the substantial majority raised issues of concerns over privilege in terms of auditors getting corroborative information and how they're going to do that without having to violate attorney-client privilege. And one last observation I'll just make about in a summary of the standards is many of the comment letters we looked at were supportive of the board's approach for principles-based standards. But some of those same comment letters asked for detailed implementation guidance. And as we pointed out in the briefing paper, the FASB had a 2002 proposal for principles-based standards, and they said a move to principles-based standards requires at least two things. One is the standard setter's ability to resist calls for more detailed implementation guidance, and the second was that regulators and investors have to be willing to tolerate less comparability and more diversity. And in some of the letters, that was an expectation gap that may need to be addressed. With that, what I'd like to do is turn it over to the first discussion question, which is addressing the increase of fair values estimates and judgments. And Mike Gallagher from PricewaterhouseCoopers has agreed to lead off this first topic about challenges to auditing given the greater diversity in some of these standards. Mike?
Thank you, Tony. Good to see you. At the last session, we talked about the pace of change and potentially the challenges to the quality of the standards. And one of the things that we got into was the movement towards more judgment. And clearly, what we have today is not absolute rules, and where we're going is not absolute judgment. This is a continuum. I'll tip my hand at the beginning. I'm, as I said at the last session, I think it's a step in the right direction. Right? Movement towards greater judgment is a positive thing, but certainly it's got, some issues that need to be dealt with. Tony, I think you did a good job of teeing up, some of the obvious judgments that come with some of the new standards. Revenue recognition, just by way of example, contingent consideration, which in the past, largely had been recognized at the, completion or the outcome of the contingency, will now be recognized, when it's reliably estimable based on some probability weighting. So that's certainly a matter of judgment. And as the question tees up, you could get, similar facts or almost identical facts, and you can have people make different judgments. Financial instruments, certainly the greater use, as Tony said, the greater use of level three valuations, and certainly that was an issue that was identified in the 4010 report. The interesting part about that is in the most extreme circumstances, we went to level three, and we went there very quickly, and a lot of people had to move and make judgments with very little time under very extreme circumstances. But as we move to more fair value and more prolific use of fair value, certainly level three will become more prolific and will require much greater judgment, and by definition, you will have different answers and therefore a lack of consistency or comparability. Leasing. Now that everything will be on the balance sheet, there is no longer a concept of an operating lease. There's the right to use model, so there will be a balance sheet entry when you enter into a lease, and that number will change based upon a number of different assumptions, including something as basic. It sounds simple, but lease term. You know, lease term is anything but simple when you think about options and when you think about, you know, the definition, you know, the longest possible term that's more likely to occur, more likely than not to occur. So, you know, that's very judgmental and could change significantly from period to period, and certainly different people can end up with different judgments. Under the auditing standards, you currently have a requirement, and it makes sense that to the extent that judgment increases and you're applying judgment, the documentation should increase. So by definition, our audit files will be getting a little bit more hefty, for sure. But you get into the issue of could different people come up with different reasonable judgments. One, you know, doesn't necessarily need to be wrong in order for the other to be right. So the challenges, you know, are clear. Comparability and consistency is the obvious one. From an investor standpoint, does that serve the community to have potentially different answers on very similar facts? I think the challenge there will largely get to the quality of disclosure. Will the disclosures be the link between and make things a little bit more comparable if you compare those disclosures? And will the disclosures do a good job of connecting the accounting with the economics? And I think that will be the real challenge. And if you look at rules versus judgment, you know, it's interesting, the dichotomy that you mentioned, Tony, that people are asking for principles, but they're saying, well, give me a rule that helps me interpret the principle. And I understand that, you know, rules are a hard thing to kind of wean yourself off of. That, you know, rules can be very comfortable from an auditor standpoint sometime, for sure. I'll speak for myself from my perspective. When you're in a challenging conversation with a client regarding an issue, and if you have a rule there, sometimes it makes that conversation a little bit easier to say, well, you know, this is the rule, as opposed to management making a judgment and our firm making a judgment, me making a judgment, and having a difference of view when there's nothing definitive that says, well, you know, show me in the rule book where I'm wrong and you're right. And yet it's still important for an auditor to stand up. It's important for controllers and so forth, you know, to express their views, and recognizing that there may be a range of acceptable answers. Just because something's judgmental doesn't mean anything goes. I mean, there are judgments that are not within the realm of acceptability, and so certainly the profession would need to stand up, and to the extent that judgments are outside that realm of acceptable, being able to stand up in the absence of having the comfort of a rule, you know, to rely on. So that will be a challenge. But I think the benefits are significant as well. You know, I think if it's done right, I think, you know, having principles versus specific rules can end up with better financial reporting and will serve the user community better. The more rules you have, the more you're trying to fit similar transactions that may not be identical, you know, into a box that may not fit so neatly. And if you look at the amount of rules that have accumulated over so many years, and leasing to me is a great example. You know, you have so many complicated rules as they exist today in applying leasing, and I'm convinced if you're a good accountant and you make a good judgment and you try to connect the accounting with the economics with respect to leasing as it exists today, you're almost guaranteed to get the wrong answer, because the accounting as it exists today in many cases is counterintuitive. We'll go back to the middle of this decade. Where you had so many restatements. You had roughly 10% of all public companies end up restating their financial statements, and many of those had to do with leasing. You had the retail community, which, you know, obviously is very much in the leasing. There were massive amounts of restatements, and again, largely, you know, that accounting in that sector built up over time, and it built up by people applying reasonable judgment. But you know what? The rule was fairly clear, and if you followed the rule, you got a very different answer. So I think the use of judgment and having principles versus rules, hopefully there's far less of them. It's easier to comprehend because as it exists today, no one individual could possibly understand all the rules that are out there, hence the need for a national office at each of the big four firms And quite frankly, it's a challenge even for people that spend a lot of time in this day in and day out. So going to, you know, to more principles and having it be more intuitive and having the accounting be better linked to the economics and reliance on good, high-quality disclosures, not to make up for bad accounting, but to better describe the basis of accounting and why it makes sense and why it might be a little bit different. So I think those benefits are significant. And I guess the last thing I'd say about the benefits is I think it's an opportunity, you know, again, maybe speaking a little bit selfishly, I think it's a benefit for the profession, and it gives the profession an opportunity to elevate itself in providing value to the capital markets, in helping our clients, audit committees, management teams, et cetera, in making high-quality judgments that will better reflect economics in the financial statements, as opposed to being there to, you know, explain to the controller where in 20,000 pages of U.S. GAAP where the rule is that tells you what to do. Okay, you know, not giving the recipe, but helping our clients and audit committees make high-quality judgments, I think is good for the profession. So from an auditing standpoint, I guess the question comes up, and I know we'll discuss it, is what does this mean in terms of the need for auditing rules? And do these accounting rules precipitate that need? And as I look at it, I really don't see it. I mean, I'm open as these things develop, and you know, practice will develop, and we'll see what happens. But I certainly today would not call for a specific need for, you know, for auditing standards to address some of the accounting issues. I think one of the things that we discussed at our last session was an auditor judgment framework. I think that should certainly be explored. I know there's two sides to that coin, but you know, on balance, I guess the way I look at the auditor judgment framework, similar to what the Committee to Improve Financial Reporting came up with on the accounting side, is, you know, can we come up with some best practices or a process that hopefully will result in high-quality judgments? Again, not a checklist approach, and just as there shouldn't be a safe harbor for a poorly done or poorly executed framework, I don't think the absence of documenting the framework every single time is indicative of a low-quality judgment. I think that ultimately the judgments need to stand on their own, and if the judgments are documented properly and they're well thought out based on the facts that are known at the time, that's ultimately what we're getting at. But I think an auditor judgment framework that provides, you know, a process for auditors and others to think about how do you make high-quality judgments will raise the quality of judgments that are out there, and hopefully, again, not to create a safe harbor, hopefully avoid the crash rather than trying to figure out who to blame after the crash occurs. So, Marty, those are, and Tony, those are my thoughts, hopefully, to tee up a good discussion.
Okay, thanks. And with that, we'll open it up for other questions. One thing I will note, you had mentioned the framework. I know not some of the members weren't here yesterday. I think Dan had talked about the PCOB's thoughts around the framework. And I think at the last SAG meeting, Brian Croteau had mentioned that the framework is out there. Those 11 principles are out there for firms and issuers to look at. And I think we heard that some issuers in terms of dealing with the SEC are currently and Corp Fin and OCA at the SEC may be applying those same principles without any formal guidance. So.
Mike, I have a follow-up question for you, if that's all right.
Sure.
I was wondering about your view about the staffing model. Given what's been described here of a much more a framework that's filled with much more judgments and estimates and lack of rules in many cases, lack of application guidance, and given the fact that most audits follow sort of a pyramid approach where I think everybody's aware of the fact that a very large proportion of the audit work gets done by people with 1 to 6 years experience, for instance, who are in the past have been trained on rules as they came through, you know, their accounting programs and auditing programs and understood what the rule was in a certain area. Mm-hmm. To what extent do you think that model is going to change in terms of will you need to staff jobs with people with greater experience in order for them to audit something where they're auditing a judgment that's been made and the judgment, therefore, they have to bring to that situation?
Yeah, Marty, I think it's a good point.
But as I think about staffing today, you know, generally you're not having the first-year staff person, you know, devote, you know, even on, in a rules-based environment, you know, go find the rule, or, you know, I think that's generally done by the more senior staff in any event. When you get into more judgment, you know, obviously the judgments that are most material, the judgments that are most complex, and as I said, you know, at the outset, you know, this is not, you know, a light switch where we went from 100% rules to, you know, 100% judgment. You know, I think we're moving on the continuum. But, you know, so clearly the more important judgments, the more material judgments, the more complex judgments will continue to be need to be made by the more experienced people on the engagement. You know, whether that movement is a significant shift and will require a significant shift in the staffing model, I don't think so just yet, because I don't think it's that gigantic of a shift. But, you know, certainly we'll have to, you know, we'll have to deal with that as, you know, as practice develops.
Okay, Lynn Turner.
A number of thoughts here, Marty, and let me start by saying I think I couldn't agree more with Mike about the fact we're all trying to get to good judgments here. It's what it's all about. The problem in the past, though, hasn't been the good judgments. It was the ones that were out of whack, and those were the ones that cost investors a ton of money, and ultimately, in all likelihood, cost the firms a lot of money through litigation costs. So I think to some degree the focus has got to be on how do we make sure we don't get into those situations again. I personally think if we go down this path with the standards, it would behoove the PCAOB to get ahead of the game and do some new auditing standards, go back into the estimates standard and all, and beef it up. and that includes all the nuts and bolts that go with it, including the staffing model. I think the question you raised, Marty, is absolutely an excellent one. I'm surprised by Mike's comment that he doesn't think the staffing model needs to change. I think with the additional judgment that's going to be required here, there's going to need to be significant changes. I think early on in the process, you're going to need much more experienced people getting into these judgments. A lot of these judgments on the preparer side will be made by people that are sitting there at the business with 10, 15, 20 years of experience. And to think that you can send out an auditor with 1 to 6 years and understand that the 1 year aren't making some of these judgments, but it sure isn't a person out there either with even remotely close to the experience level that's going to be in that the company has when they have to make those decisions. And in fact, the people out there are out there from the audit firm for only a limited period of time. So I think the business model needs to be examined. And that includes the responsibility of the partner in terms of billing responsibility. Right now, the partners have a tremendous amount of billing responsibility. They're responsible for knocking down so many hours and so much in revenues with these documents coming out. If we got the partner still responsible for as many hours as they are today and as much in fees, we're going to have a train wreck, because you're just not going to be able to bring the experience that you need to decisions. They're not going to get enough attention of the partner, because his feet or her feet are going to be held to the table for those billings, and we're going to have a real problem with respect to that. I think as far as the judgment framework, I think it's absolutely very important that in these standards, the FASB turns around and lays down a standard for what they expect to be documented by the preparer. If it isn't getting documented by the preparer, the likelihood that the auditor is going to do a good job of auditing those judgments drops dramatically, and the odds are we will have problems. I'm very concerned when I look at the standards that the FASB is writing them just as they have in the past, and isn't getting into the documentation that's going to be required. And people may say, well, that shouldn't go into accounting standards. Well, these aren't standards like what we've had in the past, and what we've had in the past isn't going to work in this environment. So I think it's very important that, as the CIFRA committee recommended, that the companies do go through a process for making these estimates and judgments, and that process is well documented, so there's something there for the auditor to audit. I am vehemently opposed to a safe harbor of any shape, kind, or form, because all that does will get us into bad judgments. I listened to Jim Scher say something yesterday that really resonated with me. He said, you know, liability does have an impact on what the auditors do. And I couldn't agree with him more. I think liability does have a big impact on how auditors behave and think. And when you remove that liability, they behave totally different. So I think any notion, consistent with what Jim said, any notion of a liability cap on these judgments or a safe harbor should be totally off the table and out of discussion. As far as back to the reasonable judgments, Michael mentioned the 200 to 300 restatements that there were for leases amongst the business community back in the 3-4 years ago. When you look at those, that had nothing to do with reasonable judgment. Most of those restatements were a flat-out violation of the rule. And that's the thing that we're very concerned about. And in fact, I remember being on the phone with the controller of one of the largest retailers when he turned around and said, Lynn, we'd like you to go lobby the SEC with us. And I said, well, lobby him on what? He says, well, this thing on leases, what they're asking us to do a restatement. I said, well, did you comply with the rule? And he said, no. But none of us were. So as long as we were all breaking the rule, let's go ahead and the firms have all bought off on the financial statement. Let's go lobby the SEC and Congress and see if we can't get them to agree that we get a pass. That's the type of judgments that we're talking about that are dangerous. And those have nothing to do with the notion of good or bad judgments. Those were just flat-out violation of the rules that the firms gave them a pass on and never should. And I think once it did get into the national offices did the right thing for the most part and got the restatements done. But the rules were very clear and everyone knew what they were at that point in time. The last thing, which comes back to our discussion yesterday, and I think this is extremely important. When we're talking about the risk things, the risk standards, we got into this discussion about whether or not the auditor has to search for just corroborating information for management's numbers or whether the auditor has to search for contrary evidence. And when you start doing these type of judgments, if it isn't clear that the auditor has to search for contrary evidence, we will absolutely have poor judgments. So one of the things that needs to be clarified, as we heard yesterday, and I understand it's very consistent with the new risk standards, is the auditor has an obligation to look and see if there's contrary information, and if so, give that due consideration vis-a-vis what corroborating information management is given, and then make a truly independent decision. Because today, I think, all too often, the auditors have just gotten corroborating information from management and left it at that. And if we're required to make some of these very significant estimates, and the auditors do that, all I can say is God save them, because I think we'll have some real problems, and those of us on the investor side will be coming back and trying to recoup our losses.
Okay, thanks, Lynn. That was good input and a good counterpoint to Mike's comments. Charlie Niemeyer?
I just wanted to raise one thing, and that is that, you know, we have a lot of discussion about how disclosure will be a solution to the problem. So the wild pitches will be caught, you know, by disclosure. What I want to point out is just that I think we should recognize that disclosure is not an area of strength in U.S. financial reporting today. I think there's a number of reasons for that. Perhaps when it comes to materiality, auditors, companies, audit committees even don't quite know what to do with it. But the end result is the same. I think we certainly saw it in the economic crisis, where even companies, financial institutions that complied with the accounting standards as far as the numbers presentation did not comply as far as disclosure. And there was a sort of a rampant failure to comply with the disclosure requirements in that regard. And so I just sort of question whether disclosure is a reasonable backstop. If we're going to do that, that's fine. Certainly I'm not against better disclosure. Certainly we should be doing that. But I think we have to do something as an effort to improve disclosure for it to be reasonable.
Thanks, Charlie. Wayne Collins, I believe you were next.
Yeah, I just wanted to drill down in the prior discussion we had about the revenue ED. On the one hand, certainly it's great to see that we have a significant reduction of the standards. I mean, it's like a telephone book of standards we have now, and the ED proposes a very robust revenue framework, which is, I think, going to make it easier and perhaps more consistent analysis of determining whether revenue is appropriately recognized. Supplementing Mike's comments on the revenue part, I mean, you're starting off with a reasonable estimation of the variables that go into a transaction price, contingencies, rebates, refunds, and reasonably estimated is a lower threshold than the current gap is. So to that extent, you've increased the amount of judgment that's required. The probability weightings that may be needed in assessing and measuring these variables are going to have to be updated each reporting period. And to connect it to a statement that was made yesterday, you've got, you know, 60-day reporting requirement at the year end and more accelerated during the quarters. And all of these estimates are going to have to be done within that same time frame, which adds to the difficulty in the measurement process. In the contingent revenues, you've got and the contingent revenue is probably the primary variable that is that could be included in the transaction price. You've got things that could be very judgmental, like future royalty payments that are contingent on a customer's sales, and that would have to be included in the current revenue if it's reasonably estimated. And there could be possibly issuers, including from just a business standpoint, more of these types of arrangements in a transaction as a result of the new accounting treatment for them. Then once you get the transaction price, you wind up allocating it to the separate performance obligations, so separate and distinct obligations, another judgment, whether something is separate and distinct. And then when you're allocating the transaction price, you're doing it based on estimated selling prices. There has been recent experience dealing with that in the software business, but still there are situations where an estimated price may be difficult to come up with because there are not independent sales of the same product. Competitors aren't selling it separately. So, again, that's something adding to the judgment calls. In terms of the credit worthiness, which is an upfront measurement that has to be done rather than the back end where you're looking to see whether collectability is reasonably assured, but now you're estimating the credit worthiness up front. There's an interesting element of this, and on the one hand, you're reducing significantly the plethora of industry-specific guidance around, but on the other hand, you're basically eliminating that industry-specific guidance. So it's very likely that there will be calls among preparers, auditors, for more guidance to how to apply the more robust uniform framework to specific industry situations. So that's perhaps where additional guidance may be needed. The form of that guidance, I don't know at the present time, but I think that's likely to be called for. Another area where judgment is going to be required is if you have a continuous transfer of a product. The old percentage of completion accounting is an example. And determining whether something or a product is customer-specific is another judgment call as to what model that you apply to those situations. Contract modifications is another judgment call because that determines what the accounting is. Even the cost, determining whether something is a pre-contract cost, which needs to be expensed, versus a post-contract cost, which doesn't get expensed, is another judgment call. Then you deal with the disclosures, and the disclosures around the measurements and the judgments that are required will be another interesting judgment in determining the extent to which the disclosures are appropriate, because there's a lot of judgment that goes into what is a reasonable amount of disclosure surrounding the company's accounting. Then you're looking at all the accounting parts, and you're saying, okay, now I have to evaluate the company's internal controls over financial reporting to the extent you've got an accelerated filer. So the same judgments that are applied in determining what the accounting is, or similar judgments, will be applied to determining whether the company has the appropriate controls to do that accounting. And in all of this, when you put it all in one pot, maybe piling on the judgment framework, which we mentioned today again, without a safe harbor, but the judgment framework that's for preparers, that's for auditors, and that everybody could look to as a consistent way of analyzing what the appropriate accounting would be, I think is sorely needed in this situation.
Wayne, thanks. A lot of good points there. As I listened to those in the context of some of the comments, good comments that Mike made and the points Lynn and Charlie and others have made, clearly, as you pointed all these things out, it cried out for a need for something, therefore, in order to have financial reporting and auditing that's going to be reliable. So in your view, I don't know if you want to answer which one of these three were the best, because I've heard some of these ideas come up, but do you think it's in need of more application guidance with respect to the standards? As I heard Lynn say, is it in need of preparer documentation requirements surrounding these judgments, or increased auditing guidance around the process of auditing estimates, or is it all three?
I was going to say, do I just have to pick one of the three? I think the first two are basically part of the same, because I think part of the CIPA recommendations would be that these judgments need to be appropriately documented. So I think I would blend those two together, and it's likely that there will be some application guidance that's needed. I think we're going to have to see how it goes along. I certainly wouldn't foreclose it.
Thank you.
Barbara Roper.
Yeah, I want to start with something. I agree with most of what Lynn said, particularly on the issues regarding documentation and the need to find something other than corroborating information, and what he talked about, the unacceptability of having a safe harbor. But I do want to take exception to one thing he said, starting out, which is that we're all trying to get to good judgments. And the reality is that there always have been and always will be companies that are trying to get to bad judgments, and not because they're trying to commit fraud necessarily, but because they're overly aggressive. And they manage to convince themselves, and too often they've also managed to convince their auditors, that what the judgment they're getting at is within that range of acceptability. And it seems to me that what we're doing here with this approach is moving towards something that arguably could give us better financial statements for good companies, companies that are trying to get to good judgments. Maybe we get to financial statements that better reflect the actual financial condition of the company. Although even that comes with a price, because we're told the price is less comparability, more divergence of practice, when we were sold convergence on the grounds that it created more comparability. But we'll leave that aside for a moment. But we are creating standards that will make it easier for bad companies, overly aggressive companies, to push the edge of the envelope and argue that their judgments are within that range of acceptability. And we are creating standards that will make it considerably harder for auditors to do what they already have a lot of trouble doing, which is challenge those judgments and argue that they're not within the range of acceptability. Because, as you say, you know, with that, deprived of that argument of it's, you know, it's against the rules, how do you push back against the judgments? They're not always willing to do it now. So we're going to promote more of the kind of things that auditors currently do poorly. And, you know, I feel like you sort of watching the front end of a train wreck. That what's going to happen is at some point in some fairly significant cases, we're going to go outside the bounds of what's acceptable. There are going to be a rash of these major accounting frauds again, and the whole system's going to blow up. And nobody at that point is going to care that the auditors followed something that looked like a reasonable judgment framework. I mean, the level of anger from Congress and the public is going to be extensive. And I just think this is, you know, that since we appear to be heading this direction, really nailing down some of these issues, like having to document, you know, there has to be some documentation that you can reasonably expect to audit. There has to be documentation then on the auditors of how they got comfortable with those estimates, and there absolutely has to be something in the process that looks at more than just corroborating what it was that management set out to do. There has to be, you know, something that really sort of formalizes that requirement for skepticism and to approach those estimates and valuations and judgments with a real skepticism that has been pretty, you know, hard to find at times.